We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk, former co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
No job this morning. He's
taking a rest.
Taking another rest. Mm-hmm. So, but we still have plenty to cover. So, mm-hmm. Starting with local and tolling on 405.
Yeah, tolling on I-405 was a big topic last week in the state Senate. When state Senate Republicans fired the state transportation secretary, Lynn Peterson, and the Washington Department of Transportation this week released its statement of the tolls that it's collected on I-405 since September 27th of 2015, when they started the tolling on I-405. The agency estimated that it would collect about $1 million from the start of tolling through the end of the year. That would be about one quarter's worth of revenue. But in fact, they actually collected about $3.7 million. After expenses are subtracted out, the state cleared about $2.7 million in net profit from tolling on I-405. Of course, that money is going to pay for other transportation projects. And that also means that a full year of tolling on I-405 would bring in about $10 to $11 million per year. So, of course, there's no doubt in anyone's mind that tolling can be profitable and can generate revenue for state transportation projects, especially since other revenue sources have literally disappeared. For example, Tim Eymann's initiatives that cut car tab fees and limited tax increases have had a big impact on the state transportation budget. Something else that's had a big impact on the state transportation budget is the fact that Republicans in the legislature can't get together to pass a state transportation funding bill, particularly for new construction. But Republicans are in the state legislature are saying that tolls are adding to congestion on I-405, and that was one of the excuses that they used to fire the state transportation secretary. But a new report by Kirkland-based INRIX, a private company that set out to study the impact of tolling on I-405, said that while HOV lanes are running faster on I-405, the general purpose lanes are getting slower for most drivers. But the report, and this flies in the face of what the Washington Department of Transportation is saying. They've been saying that, oh no, travel times are getting faster on I-405 since the tolling started. The report, I should point out, focused on only four stretches of I-405, and at least three of those are notorious choke points. For example, the area north of Bothell at SR 527 is a notorious choke point that goes from five lanes down to three lanes. So traffic congestion, you could argue that traffic congestion is going to get worse there regardless of what the state does in terms of tolling. And also the 520 interchange was another area that they studied, another notorious choke point on I-405. So clearly the sample size and the scope of the study are at issue here when it comes to whether or not the study was a fair look at it. WashDOT says that the rest of 405 is seeing improved traffic flow, especially carpool lane, especially, you know, folks in carpools using the HOV lanes and transit. Buses are seeing much more reliable times and much faster travel times than they were previously, and they've been getting a definite benefit. Now, clearly, tolling is at least helping the state limit greenhouse gases from the transportation sector, and that's definitely a goal that Governor Inslee has put forward, and that lawmakers in Olympia down at the state legislature have been resisting putting into law any kind of regulations that would limit the transportation sector and that would deal with greenhouse gas emissions. The transportation sector is our biggest greenhouse gas emitter in the state, so something needs to be done definitely about it. And tolling, which was put in place in order to raise revenue for transportation projects, is having the effect of moving people away from their single passenger automobiles and more folks getting onto buses and doubling up or tripling up to use, in the case of I-405, tripling up to use the HOV lanes without having to pay the toll.
All right. Also this week, a couple of resignations related to the Department of Corrections.
Yeah, the Department of Corrections back in December The media released a news report that the Department of Corrections had been improperly calculating the sentences for inmates in the state of Washington because of a computer error at the Department of Corrections. As many as 3,700 inmates may have been released early because of this computer error since 2002. Now, that scandal at the Department of Corrections, when the news first broke, nobody stepped forward to say, hey, it's my fault, naturally. And the governor and the head of the Department of Corrections didn't come forward and point a finger and say this person is to blame. And so it's taken some time for some of it all to fall out. This week, two people resigned at the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections Secretary Dan Pachulka, who claims that he first learned about the problem in December along with everyone else, and Assistant Attorney General Rhonda Larson, who's known about the problem for much longer, back in December 2012 when a victim's family notified the Department of Corrections of the problem. Larson wrote an email saying that DOC personnel should not calculate sentences by hand because the problem had been going on for so long that a few more months wouldn't matter. They could just let the computers continue to make mistakes while the software was being upgraded and fixed. Now, unfortunately, the software was never fixed, and those few months that she referred to in her email stretched on to more than 3 years. Larson went on to say in her email, quote, "This is something that the DOC has identified internally rather than something that is being forced upon it by an outside entity such as the court. It is therefore not so urgent as to require the large input of personnel resources to do hand calculations of hundreds of sentences." So clearly she's making a risk assessment there. You know, what would be the risk if an outside agency were to find out? Well, what's the likelihood of that since it was found internally, when in fact it wasn't actually found internally? It was found by the families of a victim who realized that the perpetrator, the person who had killed their son or daughter, I don't remember the sex of the victim, had been released months too early. So yes, an outside group found it. So clearly she was in the wrong there. But all of this really kind of points out to me that she has been scapegoated because there's an email that she wrote. There's a written record of her saying we shouldn't, you know, calculate sentences by hand. And because nobody's found any written evidence for anybody else who may have been responsible for this decision, no other heads have rolled, at least not yet. So it looks like Larson is taking the fall because she got caught about putting something incriminating into email, which leaves a written record. So it really makes me wonder if the person or persons responsible for not fixing the computer system, not getting that done, even when it appears that Larson thought that that was a work in progress, that person is still not taking responsibility for the decision that they made or the work that they didn't do.
Well, perhaps further investigations will dig that up as time goes on.
Maybe. We'll see.
Yeah, I guess we will see. So, excuse me, State Department of Social and Health Services.
Yeah, the state. There have been many problems at the State Department of Social and Health Services. This week it was announced that there was a settlement in a lawsuit by two teenage girls against DSHS this week over sexual abuse that they had suffered while in foster care. The girls were awarded $8 million by a jury that found the girls had been assigned by DSHS to a foster family back in 2003. The family had two sons who abused the girls over several years. DSHS apparently knew before they placed the girls in that family that one of the sons had been accused of sexually abusing his five-year-old cousin, and yet they went ahead with a placement, which the jury found to be negligent. DSHS then didn't follow up at all to check on the girls or on how the foster family was doing, which, again, you can argue is negligent. But you should also think for a minute, too, as I do, that it's an example of underfunding, understaffing, which is chronic at DSHS, and possibly also mismanagement at the state agency that's tasked with child welfare here in the state of Washington.
And a reflection on the bigger picture of the defunding of so many
government services. Yes.
And then blaming them for not doing things properly.
Mm-hmm.
Cut out your support. All right, moving on to national and the New Hampshire primary this week.
Yeah, the main news out of the New Hampshire primary, naturally the mainstream media went all out on reporting about Donald Trump's 30% take of the popular vote in the New Hampshire primary and called that an astounding win by Donald Trump on the Republican side. But of course, they were pretty quick to move on after announcing that Bernie Sanders won 60% on the Democrat side. They obsessed about the fall of Marco Rubio and his poor performance at the New Hampshire debate, although I should point out that he's still in the race, while a couple of other candidates are not, namely Chris Christie and Carly Fiorina. So the field is thinning, and we may see that Donald Trump can no longer maintain a wildly large lead with only 30% of the vote. So that's something to celebrate, I think, about the New Hampshire primary, that at least two of the Republican candidates have dropped out. Now, the media also called it a humiliating loss for Hillary Clinton. But then instead of actually talking about any real reasons about why she lost, they went on to focus on the huge what they thought of as a huge scandal about comments that Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem made to young women, particularly young women who were voting for Bernie Sanders rather than Hillary Clinton. And what I found funny is that the media referred to Madeleine Albright and Gloria Steinem as, quote unquote, two icons of feminism. And I saw that in more than one place. and I was thinking, well, I think you'd have to ask, you know, how much of a feminist are you to consider Madeleine Albright, for example, as an icon of feminism? Sure, she was the first woman Secretary of State, but in terms of feminism and women's rights, I don't know, you know. Also, I was looking at this as really beside the point, but also how the whole controversy and the fact that these two wealthy, well-educated, primarily white women could make such disparaging comments about why women of color or younger women, women who are not as wealthy as they are, might support a candidate who has their interests in mind, you know, and not just vote for Hillary because she happens to be female. I thought that was something that the media was really terrible in discussing, that there's a class difference there, and that class difference was getting in the way of the media being able to see and really discuss that issue, even though they made it a bigger issue than it really needed to be. Now, in the meantime, Bernie Sanders, as I said, got 60% of the popular vote, but something that the mainstream media didn't point out is that he did not get 60% of the delegates from New Hampshire, and this has been a problem all along in party politics, whether you're talking about the Republican Party or, in this case, the Democratic Party. New Hampshire, for example, has 32 total delegates, and it's the number of delegates that the candidate gets by the end of the whole primary and caucus process that determines whether he or she is going to be the Democratic Party candidate for president. Now, New Hampshire has 32 total delegates. 24 of those are apportioned via the popular vote. The remaining 8 are apportioned by however those delegates feel they want, whoever those delegates feel they want to vote for. Excuse me. Now, before the actual primary vote happened, 6 of those 8 delegates had already announced that they were going to go with Hillary Clinton, leaving 2 undecided. So out of the New Hampshire primary, Bernie Sanders was apportioned 13 delegates of 24, and Hillary Clinton was apportioned the remainder, the other yeah. And so the other 11. So then So then of those superdelegates, six of them went with Hillary Clinton, and two could potentially go with her as well, or they could go with Bernie Sanders. So he's going to come away with only 15 delegates, nowhere near the 60% that would reflect the popular vote. So I find it kind of interesting, given that the Democratic Central Committee and the Democratic establishment really supports Hillary Clinton much more than Bernie Sanders. It is no surprise to me that the superdelegates, who tend to be party insiders and folks who have been activists or volunteers with the party for a very long time, that those folks are going with Hillary Clinton, and that could really determine, even if she doesn't win the popular vote in each primary, that she could still become the candidate.
Yeah, I think it made it evident to a lot of people who, if they weren't clear on it before, that the whole concept of the superdelegate is
outdated,
contrary to
the democratic process.
Yeah. So, and what it'd be great to know, what is the process? I mean, you briefly touched on it. What is the process to become a superdelegate? You know, just exactly what does that cost?
Yeah, I should point out that a lot of superdelegates are often people who contribute a lot of money to the party. That's how they get to be a superdelegate, as they become a regular and large contributor to the party's funds.
So, all right, moving on. The Supreme Court put the brakes on some new potential regulations that were coming out.
No, actually, it's been in the news for a while that the EPA had released regulations on managing emissions from power plants. It's the main and central piece of the Obama administration's plan to tackle greenhouse gas emissions, and it's something that the Obama administration brought to the Paris Climate Conference late last year and said, you know, here, look at us, we're doing something already. We're going to force our power plants all over the United States. We're going to force states to make a 30% cut in greenhouse gas emissions from their power plants below 2005 levels by the year 2030. This is a key part of our plan when it came to the Global Climate Conference. But 27 states, or I believe it's 29 states now, plus several businesses, particularly the coal and oil industry, have taken the EPA regulations to court. Currently, it's a federal appeals court in the District of Columbia that is going to be hearing that case in June. And in January, just last month, the appeals court declined to issue a stay on the regulations, which means they basically said the regulations can go into effect at least until we've heard the case in June, typically. And then, of course, the states appealed to the Supreme Court, and typically the Supreme Court would trust the federal appeals court and say that no, until the appeals court hears the case, we're not going to issue a stay either. And this week, the Supreme Court did a historic first. The five conservative justices on the court overruled the four quote-unquote liberal justices on the court. And they said that, no, we're going to issue a stay. We're going to tell the Obama administration that it can't go forward on these regulations until while the lawsuit is being heard in the federal appeals court. This is, as I said, is a historic first. Typically, regulations issued by a government agency will be allowed to go into effect at least until a federal appeals court hears any lawsuits against it. When it's appealed to the Supreme Court, then the Supreme Court might issue a stay. But that wasn't the case this time. This time, the five conservative justices jumped in and said, okay, we're going to take the opportunity to halt the Obama administration's main climate initiative right now before the lawsuit against it has even been heard by a federal appeals court. And that was basically a political move. And pretty clearly a sign of how the Supreme Court is going to vote once the lawsuit makes its way through the appeals court process and is appealed to the Supreme Court. We can guess from this that the Supreme Court will probably overturn it.
Is that what they call activist judges?
It is.
All right.
It is.
All right. I was going to say finally, but that's not true. There's a couple more. Department of Justice suing Ferguson.
Yeah. Last week, the Department of Justice announced that it had reached an agreement with Ferguson, Missouri over police reform that would have set up a civilian review board, changed city laws, and changed the way the city's cops and courts function. Now, Ferguson erupted in public protests after the shooting of Michael Brown back in 2014, and it's where the Black Lives Matter movement really got its start. was during the protests in Ferguson. But this week, the city council in Ferguson wimped out, literally, and refused to approve the negotiated agreement, the agreement that the city of Ferguson had negotiated with the Department of Justice, because the city council members were worried that they might have to raise taxes in order to pay for the reforms. So, of course, they voted 6-0 to change the terms of the agreement. They didn't reject the agreement outright, but they decided to just change the terms on their own. Now, as a consequence, the Department of Justice immediately filed a civil lawsuit against the city of Ferguson, as they had warned that they would do if the city didn't approve the agreement that the city itself had negotiated with the Department of Justice. As part of the negotiated agreement, the DOJ had offered to actually help the city cap the costs of the reforms and had offered other free help that it could provide in making the change. But of course, that wasn't enough political insurance for council members who wanted to go back to the negotiating table. Which pretty much when you've reached an agreement, the negotiations are over. But no, they wanted to reopen the negotiations because they balked at the last minute at potentially having to raise taxes. As a result, of course, they may find that a lawsuit can be a lot more expensive than simply complying with the law and simply complying with passing the agreement and doing the reforms. So we will find out. And I'm guessing that if they lose the case, the costs could be very high and that is very likely at this point.
Mm. All right. Moving on, some information out this week about life expectancy?
Yeah, there was a report this week on life expectancy in America between high-income earners and low-income earners, really a reflection of the impact of income inequality in the United States. Now, in 1970, when income inequality was less stark than it is now, a man who was in the top 10% of income earners in the United States would be expected to live a little bit longer than someone in the bottom 10% of income earners, about a little over a year, about 1.2 years longer. Nowadays, when income inequality is much, much wider, that difference has changed. Someone in the top 10% of income earners, a man in the top 10%, can expect to live 14 years longer than a man in the bottom 10% of income earners. That difference is so stark that it has healthcare officials and economists deeply worried about what that means for healthcare spending in the United States. I think we should all be deeply worried about that, what that means about people's lives in general. But that's also a focus of how much we've cut government services and how poorly we've done in trying to help people to get out of poverty, to earn more, to have services available to them to help with healthcare issues instead of waiting until you have a crisis to go to the doctor. If we had a single payer healthcare system, for example, people could go when they first start to have symptoms of a problem, or they could have regular checkups to head off chronic diseases like heart disease and diabetes, which are taking a much bigger toll on the human on the population of the United States than it really should be.
All right. And finally, some economic news this week.
Yeah, economic news, this time from Europe. The Swedish Central Bank announced this week that it was cutting interest rates into negative territory to a negative 0.5%. Now, Japan did this a little while back, and they did it with their fingers crossed, hoping that it wouldn't send the lending markets into a tailspin. The Swedish Central Bank waited to see how things played out in Japan, and when the credit markets didn't completely collapse, the Bank of Sweden went ahead and did it too. And as a surprise, the European Central Bank announced that they were considering doing the same thing. Now, what does this mean for the credit markets and for people in general? Well, it means that banks can, well, it means that banks will have to pay to keep their deposits at the Swedish Central Bank, and if the European Central Bank does the same thing, it would mean that as well. And then banks would have to pass that difference along to customers in some way. Typically, that means they would start charging a fee for people to have have savings accounts at their bank. In other words, people would be paying in order to save money rather than receiving income for banks to use the cash that they deposit in their savings account. Which flips the idea of savings completely on its head. What is that supposed to do? How is that supposed to help the economy? Well, it's supposed to push people to take their money out of the bank and spend it. Spending typically accounts for somewhere between 70 to 80% of economic, consumer spending accounts for something between 70 and 80% of economic activity in the United States, and it's not too different in the European Union. Consumer spending is a very powerful economic driver. It also does the same thing for businesses. And instead of having big cash hoards sitting around, businesses would then be pushed to buy computers, buy furniture, buy buildings, plants, other companies, etc. So that's one way in which the banks are trying to stimulate economic activity, because Europe has done something that we've also been doing some of here in the United States, and that's not using one of the biggest tools that is available for economic stimulus. So central bank policy is only one tool that you can use to potentially stimulate your economy. Another tool that some folks, and me included, would argue is more powerful is for the government to step in and begin spending money to stimulate economic activity. In other words, some folks call this stimulus spending. I call it infrastructure spending. In other words, during an economic downturn is a really good time for the government to say, gosh, let's fix our roads and bridges. You know, let's shift from a fossil fuel economy to alternative energy, and let's put the money out there to stimulate alternative energy businesses. This, in turn, helps to put people to work and creates a very big ripple effect throughout the economy in terms of stimulating job growth and spending. So it's kind of interesting. We see this negative interest rate stuff going on in Europe. Europe has been like its own laboratory for austerity measures, where the European central government has been getting together with the German government and saying, we're going to impose austerity measures on other countries that we perceive as not having their budgets under control, and that we perceive as having weak economies, because we think austerity measures will actually stimulate the economy, when in fact it's the reverse of what we know to be true, that during economic downturns, it's actually more helpful for governments to spend money to stimulate the economy rather than cutting their budgets in the form of austerity measures. So because Europe has been doing this big, you know, Europe-wide economic laboratory where they've been testing whether or not austerity measures actually help economies, and it's been a profound disaster, we're now seeing European banks having to cut interest. European banks, the only tool really that they have left to try to stimulate their economies, we see those banks cutting interest rates into negative territory, which could eventually cause a big shock to the credit markets. And I think that this is basically showing you the bankruptcy of this notion that austerity measures actually help the economy.
All right. Any events?
Yeah, a couple of events this week. On Monday, September 15th, an event, February 15th, I'm sorry, no human testing of genetically modified bananas AgriWatch, a project of the Community Alliance for Global Justice, will deliver 57,000 signatures to the Gates Foundation to halt human feeding trials of genetically modified bananas at Iowa State University, which is being funded by the Gates Foundation. That's at the Gates Foundation building at 500 Fifth Avenue North, just east of the Seattle Center, from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. on Monday morning. On Tuesday, there's a free film screening, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution. That's at the Seattle Public Library Central Branch down at 4th and Madison downtown from 6:30 p.m. to 9 p.m. On Wednesday, got a couple of town hall events on Wednesday and Thursday. On Wednesday, Professor Jeb Wyman, author of What They Signed Up For, will talk about the invisible scars of ordinary soldiers. He'll talk about the stories of Iraq and Afghani war veterans in his book. That's at Town Hall at 8th and Seneca, downstairs at 7:30 p.m. And then on Thursday, also at Town Hall, Baz Dreisinger, founder of the Prison to College Pipeline, will speak about rethinking the global prison system. Again, that's at Town Hall at 8th and Seneca, downstairs at 7:30 p.m.
All right.